Americans of Mexican descent speak Spanish in this country. Can you trip on that? 43 million people that are American citizens speak Spanish in the United States, more so than any other place in the world except Mexico City. So that said, you know, we need to move around and save democracy. We need to save our Constitution. It belongs to all of us. And democracy is people-powered. I truly believe that from my heart.
That is the voice of Miguel Gavilan Molina on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And that's it for us today.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Don't say what you need. That's Drinking for Puddles every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to tap in, as we do every so often, with Tim Redman from 48 Hills in San Francisco. We appreciate his constant ear to the ground, you know, shoulder to the grind, and his political acumen, letting us know not only what's going on in San Francisco, but connecting the dots to what's going on nationally. And Tim, there's a lot of moving parts. I don't even know where to begin when we start talking about what's going on in San Francisco and connecting it to what is happening on the federal level. My casual observation has led me to the conclusion that there's a lot of strange bedfellows. And whether you're in Oakland, whether you're in the city, there may be a blue tinge to the political aura around us, but there seems to be a lot of backdoor cooperation, some of it more covert than others, with what's going on with the agenda that's happening nationwide. And, you know, that's how I'm seeing it, but you know a little bit more than I do, especially as it comes to the city. But what's immediately coming up for you, especially with all the stuff that's been jumping off from Supreme Court decisions on down?
Well, the first thing to think about is that if you look at, all right, a budget is a statement of your priorities, all right? A budget is a statement of what you think is important. There's no such thing as a municipal budget that has unlimited resources, right? You can't do anything with a budget. So you can't do everything. So you have to think about what's important, all right? So Daniel Lurie is the mayor of San Francisco. He is a Democrat. But his budget protects only law enforcement, only the cops, the district attorney, the jails. We're opening a new jail in San Francisco now. The jails are horribly overcrowded. They're locking up more and more people, right? This is what Daniel Lurie, he's basically saying that the most important thing in San Francisco right now is locking people up and getting homeless people off the streets. That doesn't mean into housing. That means into temporary shelter, any place where they're out of sight, out of mind. We call it the billionaire's budget because it doesn't make the very rich pay anything. Okay. Now, compare that. I'm not saying he's anything at all like Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a character, political character, completely beyond anything that we've ever seen before. Right? In my lifetime, we've never seen anything like Donald Trump. Right? I mean, I lived through Ronald Reagan. This is of an order of magnitude different. But the federal budget provides tax cuts for the very rich. The San Francisco budget does not make any effort to tax the very rich in any way. Instead, what we're doing is we're eliminating vast swaths of services that protect poor and working class people, right? On a wide, wide range. So, you know, it's very frustrating to see that in the city and county of San Francisco, we can't even look at, I mean, we got an $800 million two-year budget deficit in San Francisco. I did a little math, used some numbers I got from the IRS. And if we just taxed the 5,000 richest people in San Francisco, just the top 5,000 out of a city of 800,000 people, if we just taxed the richest 5,000 people at the level that they're saving from the Trump tax cuts, in other words, not making them pay anymore, just simply saying the money that you save from not being taxed by Trump, that would bring in between $500 million and $1 billion a year. We'd have no budget deficit. We'd have plenty of money for affordable housing. We're not even talking about that. We're not even discussing that. It's not even on the agenda in this mayor's office, right? So, and also, Lurie has been relatively quiet about Donald Trump. He has not spent a lot of time denouncing what the president is doing. He has not spent a lot of time talking about how San Francisco is a sanctuary city, fighting back against immigration policies. You know, for a while, Gavin Newsom did that. And we all thought, well, Gavin's running for president. He doesn't want to offend anybody. He also doesn't want to risk Trump taking money away from California. He's finally turned around on that. He's finally realized that that doesn't work, right? Trump is taking money away from me anyway. Same thing in San Francisco. Trump is going to take money away from San Francisco anyway, right? So what we're not hearing out of the mayor's office is a whole lot of pushback. So it's a, you know, it's a very frustrating time in San Francisco.
That's why I said I feel like there's deals that have been cut. You know, the silence of Lurie is akin to the type of silence we've seen from Pelosi and everybody else. I mean, there may be some lip service here and there, but, you know, there's been more animosity directed at Lorham Madami, you know, winning the Democratic nomination in New York City. There's been more vitriol. I've gotten press releases. You won't believe press releases from Hakeem Jeffries on down, right? About what is wrong with this guy than I have with the Trump administration, you know? And it's like, y'all are pulling out all the stops for somebody who, you know, may be the mayor of New York City than you are to the guy who's taking away money from New York and San Francisco and all these other places. It's just stunning to me. It's even more stunning that in our backyard, the Peter Thiels and the Stephen Millers and that whole cabal of people, the Elon Musk, right, who have, you know, their operations in San Francisco, who are in our proverbial backyard, who have been able to benefit from the Bay Area in general, there's been no pushback on their influence and policies that are now being enacted by the Trump administration. So you don't have to be on Trump's case. You can be on, like, what's going on with people that come out of the city and county who have had a national stage and the damage that it's doing to working class and poor people.
Yeah, it's pretty profound what's happening in New York. I agree with you. Like, there's more pushback against Zohran than there is against Trump among leading Democrats. And let's remember, why is that? Well, what is Zohran planning to do? Well, he wants to freeze rents. That's going to really annoy the real estate industry, right? He wants to have free childcare. He wants to, you know, he wants to have free transportation, and he wants to pay for this by taxing the rich. That's the key element here. Unlike Daniel Lurie, Zuerlein is actually talking about raising the income tax on the wealthiest New Yorkers to pay for basic public services. Now, this didn't used to be a radical idea in the Democratic Party. I mean, in the days since FDR, I mean, this was, remember under those radicals, Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, those radical leftists, the marginal tax rate on the richest people was 80%, right? This used to be relatively normal. The idea that we should tax the very wealthy to pay for basic public services goes back to the New Deal. That was just Democratic orthodoxy. Even Republicans agreed with that, right? And now it's turned over so much that just the idea that a guy in New York might, and imagine, Davey, imagine if he's successful. Imagine if he taxes the rich, freezes rent, makes New York City more affordable, provides free childcare, provides free public transportation. People really like it, right? That's what they're afraid of. They're afraid that this will work and that people will like it. And then all of a sudden, other mayors and other politicians will start saying, wait a minute, that's what we need to do. That's how we need to address economic inequality, right? And that has the Wall Street arm of the Democratic Party completely freaked out.
Right. You know, you were talking, Tim Redman, I'm thinking about inadvertently what people found that they liked, which was, why am I commuting 3 hours to come to San Francisco when I can do the work at home and be just as efficient? And all these businesses made buku money with everybody staying home. And yeah, we like that, you know, quality of life improved. Maybe I can actually move to a place that I can afford. And the pushback is, I need everybody to show up back here in San Francisco. Why? Because the local bodega is not making money anymore? The local bookstore is not making money? Or is it a thing of control? Or as you said, people start to find that they have a different voice and a different muscle that they want to really start to use. And that can be contagious. And then the proverbial genie is out the bag, and workers or people start demanding more accountability and et cetera, et cetera. And I think what you're talking about in New York has the potential to open up those floodgates again.
Yeah, and think about it. Who is hurt the most by workers not returning to downtown San Francisco? Well, you know, obviously it's had a huge impact across the economy, but the people who are hurt the most are the commercial landlords.
Yeah.
Those big office buildings that are owned by these huge, gigantic corporations and wealthy people. I mean, Donald Trump owns half of the Bank of America building. All right.
Wow. Oh, that's right. The one that's off Gary, right?
That's downtown, the big downtown building, the Bank of America building on California Street.
California right. Street. Thank you. Yeah. I don't know why I said Gary. Thank you.
California Street. He owns half of that. All right. It's people like that and these big real estate guys, they're suffering because they can't get the rents they used to get. Because people aren't going to, so work from home did have an impact on the city's economy, but the ones that hit hardest are the owners of commercial real estate. That's the Wall Street arm of the Democratic Party right there.
It reminds me, Tim, of private prisons, mm-hmm. which, you know, we've done shows on that have these contracts that guarantee they have to have a 90% occupancy rate.
Yep.
in a way, you know, I need a 90% occupancy rate, not just you paying the rent, but I need people in these offices. So right. Everybody's like, come on back. Come on back for what reason? So you can, you know, so we can interact with one another and brainstorm. But are we really brainstorming? Because you already have the agenda in place and you have the agenda in place without my input. So what are we brainstorming about? How to execute your brainstorm, or to really, you know, force the new ideas. So it's a very interesting time we're on. I conclude at the end of the day, it's about control. How can we control a population and keep them under constant duress and stress, you know?
And surveillance. I mean, it's much harder to watch people if they're working from home.
The other thing that's been coming up, Tim, is, or at least we were getting word, San Francisco Unified School District. Been a couple of articles that said that they are being pressured to rescind ethnic studies. And ethnic studies has been, you know, was pioneered in the city and county of San Francisco and making it a requirement from their K-12 classes, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a big push coming from some very prominent leaders, you know, in Sacramento, the political leaders and then these parent groups. That seems to be in line with the type of heavy-handedness that we're seeing with the Trump administration. Erase history, no DEI, none of this stuff. We don't, you know, it's America, America first, and anybody that goes counter to that is a problem. That caused a firestorm. We're getting word that that's not going to happen, but I don't think that fight is over. In Sacramento, we still have a resolution before us. I think it's 715B to get rid of ethnic studies. It's a constant fight. It's a constant thorn. And one might wonder, how is that happening in a city like San Francisco, which is often lambasted nationally for, quote-unquote, being too woke? And being too woke is taking ethnic studies. Being too woke is, you know, understanding the viewpoints of traditionally marginalized groups in, you know, around the world, Native Americans, African Americans, Latinos, LGBT folks, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to get your take on it. And, you know, they said, I think this is not going to happen. I saw a press release, but the fact that it came up in the first place is of concern. And I wanted to get your take on things.
Yeah, we are seeing that in San Francisco. And, you know, part of it is people are afraid of what Trump is going to do to us if we have anything called ethnic studies. That, you know, there's part of it is that. Part of it is Gavin Newsom worried about what his reputation is going to be if California has. But remember, under state law, high schools are supposed to have an ethnic studies curriculum. You're supposed to have a year of ethnic studies curriculum in California high schools. Right? The question here, of course, then becomes, what's in that curriculum? And what are we teaching when we're teaching ethnic studies? And what the teachers in San Francisco say is, well, we have a model curriculum, but really teachers should decide what goes on in the classroom. And look, you know, it's there's, as you well know, teaching ethnic studies to high school students is going to face some challenges, right? There are, we're talking about what could be in some cases very troubling, difficult conversations, particularly right now, for example, about the Middle East. Right. Then we're going to have, there are troubling conversations about, for example, reparations and the legacy of slavery. And, you know, these are things that high school students are prepared to handle and need to handle. These things need to be talked about. And, you know, the idea that high school students are too young to have serious discussions about the legacy of racism and how racism has really defined the United States of America and the historic embedded racism in this country. The idea that high school students can't handle that or that we should protect them from having that discussion is just really ridiculous.
Let me ask you this. You know, when I was in school, and we're not talking about high school, we're talking about elementary. We had books. Tom Hardy, you know, Encyclopedia Brown, Huckleberry Finn, where the N-word was there with no context. You know, maybe Huck Finn might have been a little bit, but we didn't have discussion in the class. Nobody said this is a bad word and this is where it comes from. It was just there, you know, and people found, you know, like, what's wrong with saying this? And, you know, there were fights and the whole nine. Talking about Africa. Africa was depicted still as a savage and dark continent.
Yep.
There was no conversation about Mexicans, Latinos, or Puerto Ricans. You know, I lived in New York. There was no history of brown folks at all. Definitely nothing of Asians. No LGBT stuff, none of that, right? And I think, you know, over the years, these were long, hard-fought battles to say, let's make the curriculum reflect the population that's in the school. At the same time, I was required, in order to graduate, you know, high school, to take Western Civ class. Mm-hmm. And a Western Civ class that said, you know, the center of classical civilization is Greece versus Africa or any other country, to hear about the heroic and the Enlightenment of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, who were slave owners, no mention of that. And when you brought it up, they were like, well, that was back then, but this is now, let's move forward, right? So a lot of things were sanitized, and the colonizers and, you know, them, you know, going after indigenous folks, they were heroes. And that was damn near what you were tested on. And so to me, you said uncomfortable conversations. I think the uncomfortable conversations was, you know, being in ninth grade and asking, how can you be the father of this country and be a slave owner and having the teacher get upset that you asked that question? That to me was the uncomfortable question, and, you know, and kind of sweeping that under the rug and let's move on. To me, this isn't a tit for tat, but to have the perspective of other people who are in that class, I think is important. And to see that, you know, somebody being pressured in a school district possibly not have that is just bananas to me, especially when it's, you know, we're supposed to be in this blue, you know, progressive type of space. It seems like it's going backwards at every corner.
Yeah, remember the pushback about renaming schools, right? My kids went to McKinley Elementary, and we're all supposed to keep talking about how McKinley is some kind of a hero. They named a school after him. McKinley's the father of American imperialism. McKinley was a horrible president, right? Why do we still have schools named after slave owners, right? What, you know, but I agree with you that this is, you know, when you and I were both in school, these questions weren't even raised. They weren't even talked about, right? It wasn't even the Western civilization, the idea that, and when you look at what you studied in history, but also what you studied in literature, it was all works by white people.
Right.
And that's, you know, English lit was all white people, right? Literature was, and we never heard, and it just wasn't even part of the conversation. At least if you have ethnic studies, at least it's part of the conversation.
And again, thank you, Tim, for, you know, weighing in on that. Again, I got a press release that said that they're not going to rescind ethnic studies, at least in San Francisco Unified School District. But we want to keep our eyes on things. I don't think this fight is over, especially with what is looming in Sacramento, and we'll do a whole separate show on that. Do folks see themselves as aligned with the political agenda of this current Trump administration, or do they think that their movements and their assessment is somehow disconnected and different? Because it seems like it just aligns perfectly with what they're talking about and executing.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question that I think a lot of us are trying to figure out. How much of it is just fear? How much of it is, you know, Daniel Lurie hoping that Donald Trump won't notice San Francisco? If we don't say anything about Trump, maybe we'll just fly under the radar. And you're seeing this with a lot of colleges too. You're seeing this with schools and colleges around the country. Let's not do anything to offend him. Let's get rid of anything that looks like DEI on our website. Let's try to basically hide from Trump and hope that nothing bad happens, because we need that federal money, right? Some of it is that. Some of it is, you know, Trump essentially, you know, making America safe for fundamental racism again. And, you know, some of it is like Trump, basically the way he acts and the way he says things and the things that he's doing, make it okay for people who had those feelings anyway, that kind of imperialist, white supremacist, racist, you know, some of that was there already. And what Trump is doing is trying to normalize it. And I think it's a combination of those two.
What should we be doing? Or is there even a political will to do something about it now?
Well, this, as I say, you know, Stanford University just announced that they're laying off like 170 people, and they're cutting back on a whole lot of stuff because Trump is not giving them federal money anymore. And all these people, all these, you know, institutions are looking around saying, "Oh my God, that could be us. Let's try." So the thing is, Stanford, Harvard, Columbia, these big universities, they have the ability to fight back. They have the ability to say, no, we're not going to get rid of DEI, because they've got plenty of money and they should do it. But the rest of us need to do that too. We need to say, the city of San Francisco needs to push back and say, no, we're not playing this game. We're not doing it. We are still a sanctuary city. We are still a city that believes in diversity, equity, and inclusion. We're still a city that believes in ethnic studies. What are you going to do? Take our money away? You know, If you know what San Francisco ought to be saying, in my mind, is, okay, Donald Trump, you're going to take $500 million in federal money away from San Francisco? Fine. We're going to raise that by taxing the billionaires. The same thing that you won't do. State of California, you're going to take federal money away? Fine. We'll raise that money by taxing the rich that you won't do. You know, I mean, we have to, on a local level, be able to stand up to them. And, you know, it's tough because it's all about money. It's, I mean, that's the huge cudgel that Donald Trump has.
Is it about money when you're a billionaire like that? I mean, you have more money than you can spend in a lifetime. As you're talking, Tim, I'm thinking to myself, well, that's my money. That federal money is our tax dollars.
Yes.
And we didn't have a guy who got overwhelmingly elected in terms of, like, you know, the chasm between his votes and, you know, his political opponent was like tens and hundreds of millions, where you can just look and say, you know, you're in a distinct minority. It was, you know, 90 million sat home, and we're talking about, you know, the difference of a couple of million votes out of all of it. So, you know, there's still roughly half your population that sees things one way politically versus a group that sees it another way. So with that being said, we're a sizable group of people that should not be ignored. And when we're talking about, well, I just won't give you the money, well, that's my money.
That is correct.
This is our money. It's not like you're walking into the coffers and you're saying, you know, let me see what I got in my pocket. No, damn it, this is our money. So I'm that's where I'm confused.
It is our money. And in fact, Californians, the people of the state of California, pay $80 billion more in federal taxes than the federal government gives to California.
Right.
So we are subsidizing, you know, we are subsidizing the wars that Trump is involved in. We are subsidizing the military industrial complex. We are subsidizing the private prisons. It's you and me. It's our tax dollars that are subsidizing this. And, you know, at one point, Gavin Newsom made a comment about that, but he's not doing anything about it. And the fact is, we can, as a state, as a community, we can get together and we can say, look, nobody needs, you know, $50 billion. Right. You're saying no one needs to be. Interestingly, Joran in New York just recently said on TV this weekend, we don't need billionaires, right? We don't need billionaires. No one needs $1 billion. And that's, you know, certainly no one needs $10 billion. And so we as a society can say, okay, yeah, that's our money. We're going to take it back. We're also, you know, that's our money that Jeff Bezos has used to accumulate $250 billion too. Right.
Right.
And we need to be able to say that's not okay. I mean, just think about it for a second. When you and I were growing up, when I was young, there were only three billionaires in the entire United States of America.
And we only knew one, Howard Hughes.
Howard Hughes, John Paul Getty, and the Rockefeller family.
Yeah.
That was it. That's all there was. Right. And
and the two, we didn't know if they were billionaires. They were never said. It was the fascination with Howard Hughes because he was a recluse. We didn't know what he looked like. We didn't know what he sounded like. We just heard that guy's a billionaire.
A billionaire. Okay. Now there's more than 50 billionaires just living in San Francisco.
And we're not talking about the companies themselves.
No.
That could be that are hurtling towards $1 trillion. So in other words, there's more than enough money.
There's plenty of money for all of these things. There's plenty of money to build affordable housing in San Francisco. There's plenty of money to fund education. There's plenty of money to fund all of these priorities. Plenty of money for Muni. The money's there. It's just that, again, Trump is making it okay or normalizing the idea that the rich don't have to pay any taxes.
Let me ask you this, Tim, as we kind of wrap up the recent Supreme Court decisions. How did that trickle down and impact San Francisco and the Bay Area in general?
Well, in a lot of ways. And there's several profound things that the Supreme Court has done. And one of them is basically saying that it's okay for states to deny medical care to trans youth, right? This is life-threatening in massive ways. I mean, the suicide rate among trans youth is already very high. And, you know, the American Pediatrics Association, the American Medical Association, they say that first of all, there are trans kids, and giving them gender-appropriate medical treatment is life-saving, right? And there are trans kids in a lot of states who now are risking suicide, lifelong consequences. Some of those kids will probably come to San Francisco. and where they are welcome, but where, again, we are going to need resources to take care of them.
But now, then course, we have somebody that's saying, I won't give you any money.
I won't give you any money, right? And then, of course, there's this crazy birthright citizenship thing that's, I mean, you think about that for a second. How many people in the Bay Area, how many people are born in the Bay Area to immigrant parents? Lots, lots and lots and lots. And what happens if, okay, so your parents are immigrants, you're born in the Bay Area, your parents are fleeing persecution in some other country or came here for a better life, whatever, and Trump now says, well, you're not a citizen. Well, what are you? Who are you a citizen of? You're not a citizen of, you're not a citizen of Mexico if you're born in the United States. You're right. Not a citizen of Guatemala if you're born in the United States. And if you're not a citizen of the United States, what are you? Where are you a citizen of? The chaos that, and the thing is, the Supreme Court did not specifically say that they're overturning the Constitution and saying people who are born in the United States are no longer citizens. They're just saying that a judge can't block Trump from doing that. Now, the Supreme Court could do anything it wants. The Supreme Court could simply have said, all right, one federal judge can't block something for an entire country, but let's be serious, folks. The 14th Amendment is the 14th Amendment, and you're a citizen of the United States if you're born here. Right? And put this all to rest. They didn't do that. They didn't do that. They're choosing to let this go forward in a way that's just, I mean, think about how many people in the Bay Area may be essentially born stateless. It's mind-boggling.
And even if you were born in a place, but you've been here pretty much all your life,
right?
It's still the same thing. You know, right. You don't have no family, you don't have no ties. But as we did shows last week, and I keep emphasizing to people because they think, well, you know, just, you know, they went back to Mexico. No. You went to prison first. And you're in a detention center. They're using that euphemism, detention center, but it's prison. It's prison. You're locked up. Your movements are controlled. The whole nine. It's, you know, I mean, the politics of prison apply there. The whole nine. And people, I don't think, are fully realizing. So you are here. You were born at age 5. You've been here. You're the offspring of immigrants. He decides, as he said, well, you know, the 500,000 Haitians out of here, they're now here unlawfully. Or the people that flew in here from Cambodia and Vietnam and other places, they're not citizens anymore. They're illegal. So he can use that word lawmaker and make it seem like somebody did something nefarious in getting here. And we don't see that, well, they've been here since they were 5. And now, you know, it's like, okay, well, they'll just go back to their home, but not before they go to a private prison. That, I think, is the most insidious gaslighting I've ever heard. And right. It makes me wonder if the city of San Francisco, you know, its leadership will find itself dancing with that sort of harsh contradiction and going along with it.
No, it is, people are being sent to prison, and they're sent to prison with really intolerable conditions because they're so overcrowded. And then you're being sent back home. Well, wait a minute. You've been here since you were 5 years old. Now you're 40. You have no connections. It's not being sent back home. This is home. This is where you live. This is where you've built your community. Right? No, it's absolutely intolerable. And, you know, San Francisco remains a sanctuary city. But, you know, what is the mayor doing when people are being seized in ICE hearings right here? I haven't seen Mayor Lurie protesting out in front of the ICE courthouse. The San Francisco police say they don't enforce the ICE laws, but they're not doing anything to help.
Have they held the press conference? I mean, he has a new chief and everything now, right? Or should be.
So no, we have an acting chief.
Right.
They're doing a search for a chief. Yeah.
So what have they said? You know, I mean, because I mean, they could potentially be, you know, if not directly, at least a few generations from folks who were immigrants.
There are San Francisco police officers who are the children of immigrants who were born in the United States, who Trump now wants to say maybe are not citizens anymore. Yes, this is happening across the board. And yeah, you know, I mean, we just had a drag performer who was in a Latino safe festival, was just snatched by ICE, pulled out of San Francisco, and risks being sent back to a country where being a trans person could be a death sentence. Right? And I haven't heard a word from them. The mayor came to the Pride celebration yesterday and talked about, oh, the LGBT community has always been a part of San Francisco, and said a few, you know, things like that, but never said, wait a minute, we're going to try to help locate this person. We're going to try to do something about this.
Did the organizers of Pride hold him to task over that?
No. It was just, he just came out on stage, made a few brief comments. There were a few boos in the audience. He was booed out of the trans march, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, the other one was the power of the federal judges, and a lot of rulings have come out of the Ninth Circuit. You know, what did this mean with the limitations on those federal judges and the Ninth Circuit? It seemed like this was designed to really stop them.
Right. Well, that's what the birthright citizenship case was about, that a federal judge in San Francisco doesn't have the right to put on hold Trump's national policy. But let's think about this for a second, okay? When Joe Biden was president, he signed an executive order forgiving a whole lot of student loans. Right. And remember, this is life-changing for people. There are lots of people whose life is transformed if they don't have to pay back those massive student loans. Okay, a very conservative Trump-appointed federal judge in Texas suspended that and said, nope, I'm blocking that for the entire country. Did the Supreme Court do anything about it? No.
Mm.
They let it stand. They didn't care. When it's a right-wing judge blocking Biden's executive orders, the Supreme Court didn't do a thing about it. Not a word, not a peep. But when it's a judge in the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco who's trying to stop what by any stretch is a insane, indescribably lunatic plan to get rid of birthright citizenship, the Supreme Court says, oh no, you can't do that.
And so, we're talking about a population that is, well, no, we're talking about the birthright thing. That's different thing, but yeah. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. I guess the question, where do we go from here? What do you think we should be doing, Tim?
Well, I think it starts for me, it all starts at the local level. And I think we need to be organizing at the local level and organizing at the state level and pushing back against Trump at every level and recognizing that this strategy of, you know, not criticizing Trump and flying below the radar and maybe he won't do anything to us is going to fail. It's not going to work. I think it's really important that we look at these issues and say, what can San Francisco do? What can the state of California do? The state of California can tax the billion. The state of California could have a wealth tax. State legislature could pass that tomorrow. We could have a wealth tax. We could say we're taxing 3% of the wealth of everybody who's got over $1 billion in wealth. That'll fund all of these things that Trump is cutting. We could do that, right? We can raise the state income tax on rich people. We can allow San Francisco to have an income tax on rich people, right? We can, if what we're afraid of is Trump taking all of our money away, well, why don't we go after the people who are benefiting from Trump and raise that money ourselves? Then we don't have to be afraid of Trump cutting off our funding.
Definitely, I'm glad you're planting that seed, and hopefully people, you know, coalesce around that. How can we follow your work? How can we get a hold of you? And, you know, is there any place that you would suggest people go to organize?
Yeah, well, you can follow our work at 48hills.org. You can sign up for our newsletter, and we'll send you our top stories as they come out. I'm pretty easy to reach. Tim at 48hills.org will get you to me if you have any story ideas or comments. You should be listening to Hard Knock Radio every day.
I appreciate
and,
that.
And follow the news media outlets that are trying to raise these questions.
Tim Redmond, 48 Hills, we appreciate you. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though.
Oakland, stand up.
Stand up.
Ensemble Big Now Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard not when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat till it ain't from the steel gray beats. Say, please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say, peace to the lovers I name with a please. Make some shade on your name in the street. You go.
Real Talk Radio. You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock Radio here on the Pacifica Network. Up next, we bring you a commentary featuring Rosa Clemente. Stay tuned.
Okay, so I have questions for Zoltan Mamdani. Last week, I did an interview with Charles Barron, Inez Barron, who respectively both were New York City Council people and New York State Assembly people, and also had Kali Okuno on from Cooperation Jackson. And we were talking about, you know, the primary, the upset, like Cuomo spending $25 million and then a 35-year-old Ugandan-born Indian-American beats Cuomo, you know, and it definitely did remind me a lot about AOC. Okay, so I really encourage everybody to watch the interview and share it. It's beginning a trend, right? Because all the polling has shown that particularly with older African Americans and now even older Latinos, that Zoltan is not winning them over. I think he's still gonna win, right? Like, Eric Adams is a joke. He's out at the club tonight again. Like, dude, do your job. You're a joke. You're a sexual harasser. You bow down to Trump to not be indicted for all your crimes as mayor, and you need to go. And Charles Barron has said it the best. Cuomo didn't get our vote, but Mamdani didn't earn our vote. So then the next day I posted a New York Times article that talked about what I'm saying here right now. And what I said basically, if you go and share this as well, is I said my interview last night with Barron, Okuno, and Inez Barron spoke to this issue. Check it out. Younger African Americans who did vote, right, voted for him. But he didn't win the Bronx. And part of that is because he has said nothing specifically to African Americans and also Puerto Ricans, right? So then I'm like, you know what? And then people were posting, like, I find him to be anti-Black. And you can be anti-Black and not be, like, white supremacist, okay? Right? Like, you can be anti-Black. And honestly, I do think that the DSA is anti-Black. And why do I say this? It's because they refuse to ever say the word Black. And when I mean Black, I mean specifically African-Americans in New York City, right? And people are like, it doesn't matter. It absolutely does matter, because even working class people don't have the same economic equity. And why? Because the system is against African-American Black people, right? So you could be like, well, no, New York City is this and it's that. Well, can we talk about the hundreds of thousands of, again, specifically African-American Black Caribbean people that have been gentrified out of Brooklyn? Can we talk about the mass exodus, specifically African-American people in New York City, because they can't afford to live in New York City, right? So the whole problem with the DSA is they're always like, well, working class people. You know what? White working class people in this country are treated even better than African-American and other people of color, middle class, upper class people in this country, right? Like, come on, we all know that, or we should know that. So the New York Times article was Mamdani triumph without a majority of Black votes. Where does that leave them? right? And when they say the black city leaders are worried their influence is waning, I'm like, yes, thank God. Because what they're speaking to in this article is a specific old guard of African-American Latino elders in New York City, right? The Sharptons, the Adrian Espaillats, the Reverend Daughtrys, like all of them who are sticking with Adams for the most part, right? That's the generational, and also the black church is still important, but it's not as important as it used to be because many younger African Americans are not even engaged in church in any way. Okay, so like we have to know these nuances and these specificities to understand what specifically African American Puerto Rican people in New York City should be asking from Zohran. Now, the Working Families Party, which is the reason that he won, big up to them and their growth as a potential line, but also a third party in this country, does address race, right? So it doesn't mean that even if a candidate comes out from your crew that you're all like in line with specific things, okay? So I'm gonna just get to this article. So let me see, when was this? Excuse me. So June 28th, that would have been Friday. Oh, no, that was Saturday. Okay, yes, so the article is Zohran Mamdani returns to Harlem to make his pitch to black New Yorkers. The presumptive Democratic nominee for mayor, who has struggled to make inroads with the black community, spoke at Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network on Saturday, yesterday. So read the article. I read the whole thing. So when you see it, you'll see Reverend Daughtry, you'll see Spike Lee, you'll see Sharpton, and you'll see some elders, black and Latinos, in that crowd. And in the crowd in general, it's elders. The National Action Network ain't got no young people in them because that's the old guard. And like Sharpton represents the guard. I mean, dude, like, he's not for us. He's never been for us, but that's a larger story. Okay, so I'm reading the article, right? And Sharpton does say this: nobody should take us for granted. No one person delivers the black community. Going back again to what Charles Barron said, Cuomo didn't earn our votes, and we can't just give Mamdani our vote. Okay? So then, Mr. Mamdani sought to mollify concerns Saturday that he was not focused on the priorities of black New Yorkers. What he told attendees is his focus on economic fairness transcended race and ethnicity. I'm gonna say that three times. Telling attendees that his focus on economic fairness transcended race and ethnicity. I'm gonna say it one more time. Telling attendees that his focus on economic fairness transcended race and ethnicity. And that's the whole problem right there. African-American people are telling you, you're taking them for granted. Then you want to come with this Democratic Socialist America line of the economy trumps race and ethnicity. So first of all, Zohran, have you never heard of the word intersectionality? That intersectionality given to us by Kimberly Crenshaw literally says you have to take factors into consideration: gender, race, ethnicity. One doesn't trump the other one. Again, he says his focus on economic fairness transcended race and ethnicity. This is the United States of America. Nothing trumps race or ethnicity. All right. Poor white people are treated better in this country than African-American and Puerto Ricans who are working class, middle class. African-American Puerto Ricans are citizens of this country, treated like second class citizens. So people are telling you what is wrong with your campaign, and you're still like, nah, you know, I'm, if, you know, economy trumps everything. That's Bernie Sanders' line, AOC line, and his line now. And that's completely problematic and honestly anti-black. Go look at his platform. The word black is never mentioned. If we want to talk about intersectionality, he has a whole part of his platform, right, that speaks to LGBTQIA communities, which it should speak to, which means why on your platform are you not talking about reparations for African-American people? Why on your platform are you not talking about the NYPD and their consistent killing of black and brown people in this country? Why is that not on your platform? As a Puerto Rican, I got questions. I might not be in New York City, but my entire family is, including the Bronx. Puerto Ricans have a large voting bloc in New York City. It's still the most consecrated, the biggest population of Puerto Ricans in the country is in New York City. In a statewide, though, it's Florida. But New York City, we all know, right? So as a Boricua, I want to know, do you support the independence of Puerto Rico? Because I've been trying to get AOC to answer that question for a lot of years. Do you support the independence of Puerto Rico? Do you support the decolonization meetings that are held every June, last week, at the United Nations, calling for decolonization of Puerto Rico? Do you support to help us trying to stop the gentrification going on in Puerto Rico? So, do you support reparations for black people in this country? Do you support reparations for African Americans in your city? Again, do you support the growing number of Puerto Ricans around this country and our call for decolonization? And people might say, oh, those are big, you know, it's about the United States. Yes, but New York City has the largest budget of any city in the country, $110 billion. How are you going to support keeping African-American Puerto Ricans in their homes in all the five boroughs? So when I read your platform and you don't ask any of these questions, when I want to know, again, when the NYPD kills another black and brown person, because they will, who are you going to side with? Have you sat down with the Justice Committee, Communities for Police Reform? I'm sure, you know, you're good on women, but I don't see that even talked about in your platform. Do you support the work of the Me Too movement? What are you going to do to curtail the fact that the infant mortality rate of black women dying in childbirth, specifically in the borough of Brooklyn? Are you going to address that? Are you going to address, again, the fact that in your city you want to be mayor, 50 women, black women, died giving childbirth per 100,000 women. White women, 4 die per 100,000, making New York City one of the most dangerous places for African-American women to give birth because they die in bigger numbers. That's all I'm saying. So if you don't want to be perceived as anti-black or anti-Puerto Rican, then answer questions that I have. And again, I don't represent in New York City. I'm part of a movement and an activist. The organizations that I talked about that I just dropped, particularly, again, just Justice Committee and Communities United for Police Reform and Me Too, are all based in New York City. That's my people. It don't matter that I don't live there. And honestly, you can't just win this election by ignoring us. And we can't afford for him to ignore us.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Hard Knock Radio. We messing around. Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Hard Knock Radio is in your town. Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Hard Knock Radio is good as gold. Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Hard Knock Radio will save your soul. Power to the people, revolution to the people. Power to the people, revolution to the people. Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Tune in, turn up, let your mind expand. Hard Knock Radio will get us all to stand together forever. Hard Knock.
listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Query. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Query every third Saturday at 10 p.m.